that claim, saying the balloon, quote, did not collect any intelligence while it transited the U.S. and that it did not transmit any intelligence back to China, unquote. But the Pentagon, which had promised to publicly release all information on the balloon's capability and its data, has never done so, fueling right-wing and other theories about the China threat and a Pentagon cover-up in deference to getting along with China. Thus, the fourth lesson, domestic politics may have had much to do with U.S. decision-making on the balloon flight, or at least that's the accusation from conservatives in Congress. Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin, the retiring chair of the House Select Committee on China, said in a statement recently, quote, China House, which is the year-old State Department Office of China Coordination, seems to have spent 2023 accommodating the Chinese Communist Party and axing key defensive actions like export controls and sanctions, unquote. That drew a retort from Rick Waters, the Assistant Secretary of State, then in charge of the office. Quote, the idea that in the middle of the balloon incident, where we pulled down Blinken's trip, referring to the trip that Secretary of State Antony Blinken was supposed to make, that we were somehow pulling our punches, didn't make sense, he said in an interview. If we had been pulling our punches, we would have gone ahead with the trip, unquote. I disagree. If keeping up the momentum from the Biden-Xi summit in Bali, Indonesia was policy, the Blinken trip should have gone ahead. Instead, the administration acted out of fear of the far right's accusations of being soft on China. Finally, one of the scantily reported upshots of the balloon incident is that China apologized. The Chinese side regrets the unintended entry of the airship into U.S. airspace, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said in a statement. The Biden administration did not acknowledge the apology, a rarity in diplomacy with China. Granted, the apology fell short of saying that the balloon was on a spy mission. Nevertheless, the administration could have accepted the apology, recognized that the balloon was not a reflection of a top-level Chinese decision, and moved on with Secretary Blinken's trip. Official apologies generally are few and far between in international relations, in large part because they're supposed to betray weakness. When they do occur, they should be taken seriously, which is not what happened a year ago. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 27, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Matei Carlin, Chris Gao, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Faraz Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at k.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News in depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon lawmakers are hard at work in their short legislative session, which ends March 10th. Before that end date, they've set a goal to pass a bill recriminalizing drug possession in the state. The bill is HB 4002, and lawmakers in the Joint Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response are in a work session that started at 5 p.m. this evening on that very topic. On Monday, they heard testimony for and against the bill. Last week, on Friday, they debuted new amendments to the bill, including lengthening the sentence that someone can get for drug possession from 30 to 180 days, and removing provisions that would have required law enforcement to help divert people with substance use disorder from jail time. civil rights and racial justice groups have raised concerns, saying they were kept out of the deal that brought the latest amendments to the floor, and that the changes will have a disproportionate impact on Black and brown communities, just as the war on drugs did. Advocacy groups, including the ACLU of Oregon, Latino Network, the Urban League of Portland, and the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, detailed their opposition to the bill in a press conference on Monday.
My name is Jennifer Parrish Taylor, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy at the Urban League of Portland, which is one of Oregon's oldest civil rights and social service organizations, empowering African Americans and others throughout the state. As we enter the last week of Black History Month, I've been reflecting on the nature of legacy. What is it that we leave behind? At the start of this process to repeal Measure 110, Black and brown communities were told explicitly by lawmakers that recriminalization would happen. They said recriminalization was the only option, and the legislature had to end the session with a bill. That if they didn't figure this out, we would face a ballot measure, and that would be far worse. In spite of our fears, our community turned out in droves to the public hearing on HB 4002 to lay bare our traumas, our fears, and to warn of the immediate and future violence this policy would have on our communities. We lobbied hard and reaffirmed that the theoreticals of this policy, when put into practice, would have real and lasting implications for a population that is overly represented in the worst possible ways when it comes to homelessness and criminalization. And with each individual conversation, it was clear that our warnings and data had not been heeded, let alone considered. Because of their omission, I can only think that legislators either don't believe Black and brown communities, or worse, they just don't care. Already, HB 4002 is being touted as a compromise, but at the cost of whom? Democratic leadership and Republican proponents of the ballot measure have succeeded in building a slightly larger and shinier cage for those who will be collateral of the criminal provisions of House Bill 4002, which will cause unconscionable harm and lasting violence to communities of color and other Oregonians experiencing drug addiction. I ask those legislators who believe in racial justice to vote your conscience at this moment, as this bill will pass without your vote. We ask you to demand to know the true impacts of this bill on communities of color, as those most impacted were not a part of the process. I appreciate the acute political pressures you are under not to break with leadership on this issue, but the time is always right to do what is right, even when it is hard. Don't let your legacy be one of jails and not care. This political moment will pass, but our communities will remember.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mercedes Elizalde, and I'm the Director of Advocacy at Latino Network. At Latino Network, we provide education, housing, and health services, and we also provide prevention, diversion, and reentry programs for youth and adults who are impacted by the criminal system. We know better than most what those impacts look like, not just on the person. Criminalization is never limited to the person arrested. It always has a broader impact on families and communities. Accountability is not the same as punishment. These are not synonyms, no matter how many times they're treated as such. Peers, mentorship, community support, high expectations, these are the things that offer real accountability and long-lasting improvements in health and social engagement. There is no guarantee that criminalization will improve the conditions that people in our communities are most concerned about. Multiple studies have in fact shown the opposite to be true. But we can guarantee that there will be a racially biased application of new criminal sanctions, as there are with current criminal prosecutions and the collateral consequences of those criminalizations. The Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice told lawmakers that the current criminal system is not set up and does not have sufficient staff to implement these new criminal sanctions. The Supreme Court Chief Justice told lawmakers and the court to anticipate a high failure rate with these types of deflection programs that are imagined in House Bill 4002. And that was before learning that the programs imagined in this bill will be inconsistently utilized and applied on a case-by-case basis and a zip code-by-zip code basis. To this day in Oregon, where the population is 14% Latinx, there's only one inpatient facility for substance use services that can serve Spanish-speaking men. There are zero such facilities that can serve women who speak only Spanish. Instead of solving this problem, we are creating new ones. This will delay care further, longer wait times for services, and will repeat the jail-to-streets revolving door. It is dishonest for people to say that deflection into treatment is going to happen as a result of this bill, because there is no requirement to create these programs. And even if they do exist, Police and prosecutors are not required to use them. Just to remind people, the Eve violation was also discretionary for law enforcement and how it was implemented, and we see how that has turned out. The Behavioral Health Resource Networks and the Eve violation have a goal of getting a screening and a service connection within 72 hours. Nothing proposed so far comes even close to meeting or beating that kind of rapid response. It requires miles of paperwork that does nothing to improve health and community safety. It is true that law enforcement entities have shown that they are currently don't have the capacity to connect with providers in their behavioral resource networks. They are struggling to work with the new programs and services, with only a dozen or so connections made, while behavioral health resource network providers themselves are serving tens of thousands of people every month. Even if we really felt that yet another siloed process driven by criminalization was needed and that we needed these new criminal sanctions, we need to ensure some kind of system accountability and being able to make sure we're prioritizing health and positive outcomes. The promise of expungement in this bill is vastly overstated. Today, it takes about 7 to 10 years to even be eligible and 2 years for your application to be processed. House Bill 2002 does nothing but maintain a two-year wait period. The legislation fails to show us how it will comply with federal protections for confidentially protected information regarding someone's engagement with substance use disorder services. Instead, it actually calls for broad disclosure of people's personal protected health information. 42 CFR Part 2 is federal law put into place in order to stop utilizing somebody's engagement with healthcare services in their own prosecution, which this bill explicitly does. The legislation fails to track data to show us how these programs will even work towards its intended purposes. It does not require data to be connected on connections to inpatient or outpatient treatment. Also doesn't tell us who is going to be doing the screenings, the ASAM assessments for identifying whether or not people even qualify for that inpatient or outpatient service. Again, if the goal is connection to services and making sure people are connected from chronic health issues into long-term care, where is that data and where is that strategy? Otherwise, it's just going to be a stop and frisk policy, period, full stop, old school racial profiling, if we're implementing this before any other diversion is even placed or a commitment to actually use that diversion. But again, instead of doing the right thing, instead of doing the needed work of creating those connections, funding local communities to fix their crisis response, funding local communities to provide warm handoffs from crisis response to chronic illness care, funding those local partnerships to train police how to use their connections that already exist with behavioral health resource networks, funding prevention and early intervention instead of doing any of that, this creates a parallel system that disregards services already on the ground and continues to silo our systems of response.
My name is Laren Turner. I'm an addiction specialist. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor, a recovery mentor, a certified gambling recovery mentor, a community health worker, and a mental health associate. I'm also the founder and president of Fresh Out Community-Based Reentry Program and the founder of the Oregon Black, Brown, Indigenous Advocacy Coalition, also the owner of ASA Consulting. I have both training and lived experience on what works and what doesn't to help people with substance use disorder. I'm also an expert at being a Black man in Portland, Oregon, who survived the war on drugs here. Time and time again, we have told the Oregon legislature the importance of maintaining, supporting, and expanding the public health approach to addiction. Time and time again, we have told them about the harms of generational trauma that will come from increasing police power over Black bodies. Time and time, we have urged them to focus on what works and reject what may score political points but will harm our populations. Their response, after utterly failing to implement Measure 110 with funding delays, a broken hotline, and a lack of training for police, state leaders are returning to the war on drugs to cover for their own failures. After utterly failing to fund residential treatment beds, and after Portland hasn't had a 24/7 sobriety center, they're returning to the war on drugs to cover for their own failures, and they want to impose criminal penalties on people who are living outside, on wait lists, for not getting into treatment, or stable housing to cover for their own failures. It's obscene. Let us be clear. State legislators visiting the failures of state and local governments on us. We will be the ones to suffer the consequences. Every time a police officer comes near me, I worry if I will survive the experience because so many Black men and women like me have not. Police are not trained social workers. They carry a gun. They're a threat in our populations. If police could solve addiction in America, it would already been solved. They never have, and they never will. Under House Bill 4002, as amended, whether someone gets offered deflection instead of handcuffs would depend on the police officer, the county, the availability of public defenders, and the color of their skin. Availability of treatment and a judge. Under House Bill 4,000 to 2,000 a minute. Recriminalization will go into effect before even these tepid deflection programs are in place. This is madness and is not a treatment-first approach. All the research shows that 90% of the people who are successfully in recovery do it when they are ready, not when they are forced. The threat of jail will not spur people into treatment, but spur them into crime and support their addiction. I know. I lived it. Criminal records take away hope. They take away our options for a future. There are better ways, but state lawmakers have refused to listen. Instead of punishing the individual, we need to build better systems and supports that actually work to get people connected and care. We need to bring real urgency to the crisis and have an army of outreach workers on the street and emergency detox beds and more available treatment services. Now, as we learn from the lesson of Portugal, we need every aspect of our legal and behavioral health system to be pulling together, not working against each other, to implement a full public health approach. It's not too late. Lawmakers can reverse course and stop this dangerous and reckless approach that imposes a threat of jail without treatment available. If they do not, the harm that will come from this to my community and the people that we serve rests on them. And I always like to say that it took us a long time to get into this situation, so it's going to take us a long time to get out of it. This is not an overnight fix. Addiction does not discriminate, but treatment providers and the police do.
Those were excerpts of remarks from civil rights and racial justice groups around Oregon, detailing their opposition to Oregon lawmakers' efforts to recriminalize the possession of drugs in House Bill 4002. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Matea Carlin. A new film called Matinee Baby is a raunchy, quirky, queer comedy that takes place at the historic Clinton Street Theater. The short film follows two friends and co-workers at the theater, Robbie and Noah Lee, as they meet increasingly wacky and strange Portlanders. The film features local drag queen Carla Rossi, and seeks to embody Portland queer culture in a fun, shocking, and celebratory way. The film premieres February 29th at Portland Art Museum's Center for an Untold Tomorrow Theater. I spoke with Tom Hilton, the writer and filmmaker behind Matinee Baby, to learn more about the film. What was your inspiration for making Matinee Baby?
Oh, man. Matinee Baby and I have had a very long journey together. In summer 2019, I wrote three speeches for characters that I didn't know where they were from or where they would go. And then about a year later, I wrote kind of a scenario that makes up the end, the final act of this film. And then about a year after that, I kind of discovered the world that those four pieces lived in together. And that initial version took place at a video store here in Portland, Movie Madness. And a version of that film, that script, was read in Reno, Nevada in summer of 2022. And shortly after that reading, I then switched the setting to the Clinton Street Theater, where I was hosting and still do host my show called Rocky Horror for Virgins. And then everything just then kind of continued to come bubbling out from that idea that it would be at the Clinton. But I guess the initial inspiration was these four big characters that I had kind of dreamed up and wanted to put in the same world together.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I like the idea that's sort of a collage of your imagination.
Exactly.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Sometimes the ideas come and they're not in the concept yet. You know, sometimes a writer is really lucky and they have a story in their head. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. It's a little more of a circuitous route, you know?
Totally. I'm curious, what aspects of Portland culture were you hoping to capture in this film?
Well, I mean, to me, this is like a a little Portland fairy tale fantasy. I love Portland so much and I'm so grateful to be from here and to have it be my home. And I wanted this film to feel like this kind of world where you could go several days, if you're an LGBT person, without ever interacting with a straight person, without ever like having to come in contact with conflict about your identity as an LGBT person. And I think so much of the fun and the comedy that comes from this movie is that it's existing in a world that's like totally stripped of, you know, homophobia or like outside voices about wrongness. Everybody in the film is kind of like an old school Portland weirdo character, and they're all very, very odd, sometimes disgusting, depending on your point of view, sometimes sassy, sometimes a little vacant, but none of them are cruel to each other. Everybody is operating from their own sense of truth, no matter how slanted and strange it might be. And then, of course, the movie also takes place at the Clinton Street Theater, which is where, you know, beautiful independent art, both local and pulled from all over the world, has been supported here in Portland for over 100 years and has attracted incredible luminaries like Gus Van Sant and John Waters, who have little teeny tributes peppered into the film as well. And then we also get to showcase very briefly some little other areas of Portland, just a couple of apartment buildings and houses downtown, stuff like that. And then another thing that I really wanted to add was fashion, this very Portland specific fashion sense of a lot of layers and color and strong personality and no sense of like uniform style. Everybody has a really specific fashion voice in this film, and the way that people dress was very, very important to capturing that Portland look.
What was the process of making this film like?
It was challenging and a big learning experience and very rewarding. This is my fourth short film, and my first three short films only had one or two people in them. And this has seven characters, about 20 extras, many locations, a ton of really fast dialogue. So it was a big learning curve for me personally. But then it's this wonderful kind of community experience where I get to hang out at a place that I love, the Clinton Street Theater, with a bunch of my friends. My boyfriend, Lucas O'Brien, designed the costumes. Friends of mine from high school did the makeup and the sound. Friends from college acted in it and produced it. So it's really like a special little friends and family kind of thing. And then I also got to work for the first time with a wonderful local drag artist named Carla Rossi, who I've been a huge fan of since I was in high school and who my first film was inspired by. So it was this really wonderful full circle moment. Although I guess I would say maybe not a completely looped circle, because I would love it to then branch out into me getting to make a million things with Carla for the rest of eternity. But it was great. And even just as important to the production and the making was the pre-production, because the film had a fundraising campaign that was sponsored by Pam Cutt, which is Portland Art Museum Center for an Untold Tomorrow. And that fundraising campaign allowed people to donate and all of their donations to be tax deductible through the museum. We had over 130 individual donors. We had a raffle, which had involvement from 24 local businesses. We also had businesses contribute to catering, and we had a producing sponsor, Artifact Creative Recycle, over on Division. And it was really a wonderful experience because it made the film feel like a community event from the very beginning, where a bunch of people from Portland, people that I knew, people that I didn't know, came together to make something really Portland specific.
What do you hope people take away from the film?
You know, it's funny. I really hope they take away just a sense of kind of relief and joy and lightness, because it's very rare to get a queer or LGBT-centric movie that doesn't trade in trauma or pain or, you know, some sort of deep personal struggle. I'm no stranger to pain and trauma and deep personal struggle, but for me, filmmaking is a really joyful experience, and ideas are such a wonderful thing to be gifted with. And this film in particular is just such like a nice little sweet, strange break from the world. And so I hope people recognize that a queer film really can be fun and funny and sweet and have as much value as something that is painful and can elicit just as much empathy, and that really bottom of the barrel, yucky, trashy, gross jokes are just as significant and important of an idea as a really highbrow, astute observation. They come from the same world inside of our brain. I really hope that people laugh together and that it's almost just like taking a little edible or popping a little something, you know. It's just a moment of sweetness and peace.
Have there been any misconceptions or misunderstandings of your film?
There is, without me spoiling it, there is definitely a way to look at the film as either very sex positive or very sex negative. and there's a way to look at it as very embracing of kink and proclivities, or kind of maybe the opposite of that. So I'm excited to see what people think.
Me too.
Great.
If our listeners are interested in engaging with your film more, how can they do so?
Listeners should come to Pam Cutt's Tomorrow Theater on Southeast Division on Thursday, February 29th. The doors are at 6:30 p.m. And when guests join us inside, they will be greeted to an interactive display of the film's makeup and costume designs. We will then be having a live concert of selections from the film's soundtrack by some local bands, The Apricots, Jewelry Exchange, and Chijoma. We will then be screening the film on their beautiful new screen in that beautiful restored auditorium. And then afterwards, we're going to be having a Q&A with cast and crew that's going to be moderated by some very special guests, including one person who I think a lot of Portlanders would be familiar with, who I'm really, really excited to have talk about the film with us. And that is your first opportunity in Portland to see it. If you can't make it because you have big leap day plans, you can also drive up to Seattle in March to see it at Make Believe Seattle, the genre film festival at the Northwest Film Forum on March 22nd. You can also follow me, Tom Hilton, on social media, and I will post about it pretty much every day for the next year, telling you where you can watch it.
Great. Any final thoughts?
I just wanted to say I'm really grateful to get to come on to KBOO. It is my grandpa Jim's favorite radio station. He listens to it every day. And there is a little KBOO sticker at one point in one of my favorite shots in the movie. It's a really special moment, and KBOO is right there. And I haven't been on KBOO in 10 years, and so it's a really fun day for me to come back here and do this with you. So thank you so much for the opportunity, and I really hope that people come out and make this a big gay fun party. It is a movie for everybody.
That was Tom Hilton, a writer and filmmaker based in Portland. His fourth short film, Matinee Baby, is premiering February 29th at Portland Art Museum's Center for an Untold Tomorrow Theater. More information at tomorrowtheater.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Matea Carlin.
KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO throughout February, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. for Black History Future Month, our special programming series in celebration of Black heritage. This series aims